I'm John Regan. I am a Steinway artist, which means I play Steinway pianos. I choose to play them by choice. They don't pay me because they make the greatest pianos in the world. And so a lot of times I'll do events, or they'll call me to do events that are related to things that they're doing. And they happen to be involved in, I guess, Sparkling Point and the music programs they're putting on. So they asked me if I'd come out.
Tell me a little bit about your life experiences that led you into the path of being a musician and vocalist.
Well, I am a late blooming vocalist. I started singing when I was, I just turned 40, so I was 32, 33 when I started singing. I was a piano player from the time I was two, sort of taught myself how to play, and knew by the time I was a teenager that I was going to do that. And went to music school and moved to New York when I graduated music school and started to try to make my way as a musician. But different than a lot of people, I always was sort of a leader. I never really wanted to be a sideman. I did that later, but I knew I kind of wanted to write my own songs and sing my own songs. And so I made my way to the city and started playing jazz gigs as just a piano player and started getting known as a guy that wrote his own music and played his own music. Then I started touring with Clint Eastwood's son Kyle, who's a bass player, and a very famous jazz singer named Jimmy Scott. So I did that for a while, and then when I was 32, I started thinking that I wanted to write songs and get back into pop music, and so I kind of busted out and decided I was going to start singing, even though I'd never had any template for it. And it ended up being the kind of change my career needed, because it was a very authentic story. It was me telling my own story. So I think maybe that's the story, is that once you find your own story, then you can fly a little bit. And since then, I've made a living as my own artist self.
Okay, there's a lot for us to unpack. So you were two and you started playing the piano. Was there a musician in your family?
No.
Or
my sister played the flute, but she was good, but she wasn't really, it wasn't her passion. My parents bought a cheap piano, like a lot of parents do, to try to encourage their kids to become musical. My mom is an artist, and I had a very good ear, so I could pick up anything and hear it and play it. I never really wanted to take piano lessons, though. I hated it, like a lot of people. And I, in fact, quit from the time I was like 8 to the time I was 15. So just had a piano in my house and played on my own. And so by the time I went back to school to learn how to play piano, I was already so deranged in the way that I had taught myself how to play. I sort of had to unlearn things. And to this day, I mean, I'm not schooled the same way a lot of people are. I mean, I respond to the piano in the way it feels and in the shapes that my hands make on it. I went to music school, I could read music, but I still relate to the piano much more viscerally than intellectually.
You taught yourself how to play the piano by ear and not by reading music.
Not by reading music, no. I mean, later I learned how to read music.
So you already knew how to play the piano by the time you learned how to read music.
Yeah, I mean, I it sounds silly, but I mean, I feel like I knew how to play the piano from the time I sat at the piano. I mean, it's just the way a piano and the keys feel under my fingers is more home to me than anything else. The way music looks on a page is more foreign to me than the way a piano feels in my hands. And I think that's a common thing with a lot of musicians who find their way the way I did. I don't recommend it, it's just the way I did it, you know.
And where did you move from when you decided that you're going to come to New York and pursue?
New Jersey, so it wasn't too far away.
And then you talked about later in your career deciding that you wanted to do your own vocals, to sing, to tell your story. What was your story that you thought needed to be told?
Well, I guess as a jazz musician, I mean, my perspective is that one of the reasons jazz has suffered in the last 20 years is because people ran out of stories to tell. You know, the songs that people call jazz standards now, at the time, they were pop music. And somewhere along the line, it became an accepted practice to just basically play old songs. And so everybody played the same bunch of songs. They played All the Things You Are and Misty and Rodgers and Hart and Cole Porter and Gershwin. Amazing songs, but they're 100 years old. And I think that when music stops being of now, then it starts to get relegated to museum pieces. And I started to feel like I was playing with an 80-year-old guy singing 80-year-old songs. And I just felt it wasn't a calculated move. It was just a guttural instinct. At the time, I was 33 years old, and I thought, I'm not 80, and these aren't my songs. And I respect them, and I love these songs. But what are my songs? And what would my, you know, these are songs written by guys 100 years ago saying, I'm in love with a girl, or I'm in love with a girl who doesn't love me, or this. And so it was their moment to say, this is what I feel like. And I thought, well, the most authentic thing I could do is have the balls to try to write what my moments are about.
Of course, I want to hear about that. What were some of your moments about at this point in your
girls.
Life?
Yeah, usually girls. I think what's funny as a musician is if you're lucky to have a little bit of success, you're sort of called on your own BS a little bit. And I think that you spend the first part of your career just wanting to work, just wanting to tour. And then you're touring all the time. And then that becomes a problem in itself. You're saying, oh, well, I'm stuck in the middle of Japan and I can't get a decent meal and I miss my girl and I'm, you know. So like all the things, it's like all the things you wish, it's like be careful what you wish for. So it sort of teaches you this little, to kind of make mental notes and little diaries of these microcosmic moments of your life. And so I was never a songwriter per se. I mean, I was a composer, but I was always a writer too. I mean, I'm a writer now, but I always wrote stories. So I found it really interesting to try to, I remember writing my first couple songs and saying to my music attorney, yeah, we should send these around. And he was like, why would you send your first songs you ever wrote around? And I was like, because I think they're really good. You know, I was so naive. But I think that when you start to delve into the human experience, there's such a wellspring of material for a songwriter if you're open to it. I mean, I tend to be a kind of romantic songwriter. There's a lot of guys like Randy Newman and people now, Bruce Hornsby, and guys who say like they don't want to write love songs, but I still think this is nothing like a good love song. I mean, it doesn't mean like I love you and let's love each other. Sometimes it's about I loved you and you disappeared. I mean, I just think there's something magical about trying to put the human experience in 3 minutes, you know, so it's interesting to me.
I love it. And just give me a quick glance at some of the projects that you've done, some of the tours that you've done, places that your music career has led you to.
Well, my first big gig was with Kyle Eastwood, Clint Eastwood's son. And that took me from being a maitre d' at a restaurant in New York City to headlining the top clubs and festivals around the world. I mean, south of France and Rome and, I mean, you name it, we played it. And that was amazing and my first taste of success. And then I jumped from that situation to work with Jimmy Scott, toured all over Europe, all over Japan. And then when I left Jimmy Scott's band, I decided I was going to focus on my own career. That was 2004. And since that time, I've toured Europe. I tour Europe a couple times a year. So I'm usually on the road a couple months out of the year playing markets that I do well in, like Italy, the UK, Spain, Germany, Eastern Europe. And to me, it just never gets old.
And tell me a little bit about some of the stepping stones. So you decide that you're going to be an artist, and obviously people don't just automatically walk into success. What were some of the struggling moments like for you as you were sort of establishing yourself?
Many struggles.
Yeah, and what did life look like? How did you sustain yourself?
Horrible. I mean, the funny thing is that I, you know, friends of mine who are older than me would always say to me, your 20s are terrible because you're never satisfied with anything and you wish things were different. And your 30s get a little bit better because you go, I guess, and it's really, that's been the way. I mean, I just turned 40 and I feel like I'm having a better time now than I ever had in my life. It's very tough when you're trying to find your way and trying to put yourself on the map and you're working day jobs that you hate. You feel like I had about 23 different day jobs. I worked in advertising as a secretary. I was a maitre d', I was a waiter, I worked in a cigar bar, I tested asbestos samples. I mean, I worked in Pottery Barn, I sold real estate. I mean, I did anything I could do to get my piano tuned, you know? So it's definitely difficult. I think it's even more difficult now because at least when I was coming up, there was this mythological music business, which sort of has fallen apart. And I think the one thing that keeps me active and keeps me on the map, whereas a lot of guys are not, is that I always had a big affinity for playing live. And in this day and age of no record sales and, you know, record companies falling apart, it's still about getting on the road and playing. And if you can build a following somehow, get people to come out to your shows and people all over the world liking what you do, it doesn't really matter. I mean, I sold 5,000 copies of my last record and it wasn't on a label. It was because I made it and people liked it. So it was definitely a struggle. It's a constant struggle. You know, I think when you work in the creative arts, you never know what's coming next. But that, to me, is sort of what's great about it.
So you're doing all these random jobs and doing your music, and somehow along the way you make these amazing connections working with somebody connected to Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
How? What was like some of the concrete steps that got you to that spot?
Well, it's actually a very funny story. There was a famous jazz manager named Marianne Topper who was responsible for Diana Krall's success, and Joshua Redman and a bunch of other people. And I used to send her, I think the story of my success is unashamed and unabashed self-promotion. I mean, you have to have the music down. No, you know, buts about it. But if you're playing amazingly in your apartment and nobody knows about you, it doesn't make a difference. So I used to send her postcards and, you know, this is before email, cassette tapes and, you know, flyers about where I was playing. And one night I ran into her and I introduced myself and she said, "I know who you are." And I had been sending her, you know, stuff for a long time, never getting a response. And then one day, I mean, it's a true story. I was working in a restaurant and the phone rang at the restaurant. And the person said, "Marianne Topper would like to speak to you." And I was very accustomed to that point at talking to important people who were looking for tables, reservations. So I didn't think anything of it. And she said, "I'm putting a band together for Kyle Eastwood. Do you know who he is?" I said, "Yeah, because I was just in Barnes & Noble the other day listening to his album on Sony." And she said, "Well, I want to put you in the band." And literally from that moment, I made a jump from an unknown person to at least somebody that was on the map. And that's not to say that, like, you know, because that gig ended. So I think it's a question of, once you are fortunate enough to get yourself into a situation like that, what are you going to do next? And I was just always looking to keep my solo thing going. And, you know, he ended up getting dropped from Columbia Records and that project fell apart. But I was already looking for the next thing. So, you know, I think that you have to be your own best friend, your own cheerleader, because ain't nobody, unless you're 14 and you win a modeling contest, it's very, very tough to get people interested in you based on the music that you make.
The theme for my next project that I'm working on is called The Rhythm of Change. What does that mean to you and how does it apply to your life?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting, especially being at this age and at this stage in my life. I mean, I think that maybe the most graceful and the most profound thing you can do as a artist but also as a human being is to find a way to not only accept but to embrace change, because you don't want to make the same album, you don't want to have the same argument, you don't want to have the same life every day. And I think that if you can inject that kind of spirit of embracing change into your life, into your music, into your art, whatever you do, then there's always something to be excited about. And I, you know, it's scary to change. I mean, I have a new project that I'm working on now that's a little bit different than I've normally done as an artist, but I went with it and it seems to feel really right. So I think that, you know, I think Al Pacino said, "You're as good as the chances you take." To me, that's really the truth. It's like, where are you pushing yourself to? And I know I'm as guilty as the next person of being lazy as can be, but I'm trying not to be that way.
And what is your next project?
Well, I decided instead of putting an entire album out, I'm going to do a bunch of songs, because people don't really have an appetite for 12 songs and sitting someplace for an hour. So I started with one song that I just finished and was fortunate enough to end up mixing it. It's a funny story, because I recorded most of it in my apartment in New York City. And then I put a band on top of it, and then I ended up mixing it with an amazing mix engineer named Michael Brower, who mixes Coldplay and John Mayer, and total profound artist in his own right. And it's just a much more orchestrated thing than I've ever done, much more quirky and many more. I'm usually the guy that just has a piano and a band behind him, but this is strings and Mellotron samples and all these things. And it feels like the next chapter. So I'm gonna do a bunch of songs. And already, like, a week after finishing the song, I have a ton of interest in the song. If there was ever a poster child for The Rhythm of Change, it would be me, because I had called up an old manager of mine and said, "I'm going to do an album. It's going to be like my last album." And he said to me, "Idiot, why are you going to do an album like your last album? Do something different." And it was because I almost took it up as a challenge to him that I've had a lot of signs pointing in great directions because of it. So.
Perfect. And this is the bookend question, and I think you've probably already alluded to it. We kind of started with this, but if you had to think about, kind of distill all of this life experience down to one most important lesson that you've learned, what would that be?
You know, I guess it's about getting lost in the process, because I really, nothing for anybody, especially for me, ever happened on the timeline I thought it was going to. I mean, in by some stretches of people's imagination, I mean, I'm 40 and I should be, you know, looking at, you know, the sunset of my life, but like my life just began, you know. I've been in the music business for 25 years. I can't even believe it when I say that, but I've been trying to have mainstream success for since I'm 15 years old. And I never had mainstream success, but I had a lot of success. I think by nature of the fact that I'm in this business and loving this business, that's success on its own. But I think that the real thing is just be open to every day, because if you're so busy trying to get somewhere, you're going to miss what happens. And everything happened at least 10 years later than I thought it was going to happen. But because I was doing the work all the time, it came back to me. That's what I would say, that, you know, just keep, don't stop believing in terms of, you know, like Journey said. So that's what I would say.